Louis Lapham is the editor of Harper's Magazine. In his new book, he writes, "I was born into the ranks of the equestrian class and educated to the protocols of wealth at prep school and college. Given the circumstances of my childhood, I don't know how I could have avoided an early acquaintance with the pathologies of wealth. The pathologies of the wealthy and of those obsessed with getting rich are the subjects of Lapham's new book, Money and Class in America. Money and class are subjects Lapham has also written about in his monthly Harper's column called Notebook. Lapham has had 2 tenures as editor of Harper's from 1976 to 81, then from 1983 to the present. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. His book is subtitled Observations on Our Civil Religion. I asked him in what ways he thought money had become our civil religion.
I think it's become a substitute for a number of other values, such as family or God or class or intellect. I mean, it's the doctrine of the bottom line. In other words, people establish their worth in the world and their relation to other people in terms of their cash assets.
Do you think this is true more so now than it used to be?
I think it comes and goes. I think in the American scheme of things, since the beginning in Calvinist New England, there's been two tendencies at work in the American enterprise. One of them is a spiritual one, and one of them is based on commerce and faith in the bottom line. And so I think it's more evident now, and it's more virulent now than it's been possibly since the last 20 years of the 19th century. I mean, it's like a second Gilded Age.
You start one of your chapters with an interesting quote from Ronald Reagan, and the quote is, "What I want to see above all is that this remains a country where someone can always get rich."
Right.
What I find interesting about that is that in Ronald Reagan's speeches, he doesn't really call attention to his own wealth, and we know that he's really quite wealthy, but what he does call attention to is his modest past, growing up in a working-class family, a hard-working father in a small town. And I just find that a very interesting contradiction.
Oh, I don't think so. It's a contradiction at all. I mean, that's a variation on the Horatio Alger story. In other words, young man starts with nothing, comes west to California, finds a fortune, and so forth. That's a classical American adventure. I mean, the point is you start, no matter how humble your circumstances. I think that's what he means by his quotation. I mean, it's a country in which people can always get rich. What he means is people who are born poor can find a way to fame and fortune, as in much the same way that he himself has done.
But, I mean, in a speech you wouldn't hear him talking about how he became rich or what he does with his money or how proud he is that he's rich.
No, but his entire manner conveys the sense of opulence. I mean, this is a man accustomed. He surrounds himself with Hollywood celebrities. His wife buys very expensive clothes. His friends are nouveau riche, arriviste automobile dealers, and they're all, you know, it's the whole feeling of the Reagan administration is like a golf course in Palm Springs. And he takes such pleasure in these things, and so that it's quite clear that he's comfortable with the opulent circumstances that fate has placed him.
You think that most people don't really understand what it is that money can or can't bring you.
Well, that's a very old theme. That's a Christian theme, right? I mean, the love of money is the source of all evil, says the Bible. Not money itself, but the attitude toward money and the expectation of what money can bring you. I mean, money clearly doesn't buy happiness. That is a very old story, not only an American one, but it's the story of Shakespeare's Timon of Athens. It's the story of it's the story of Midas. And I think people understand. I mean, I think if you say to somebody, "Look, money doesn't buy you happiness," I think everybody in the United States would nod their heads and say, "Of course, you're absolutely right."
Well, we've all seen the movies where,
where
someone
sure
gets really wealthy and it doesn't buy them the happiness they expected, and it actually leads to their downfall.
True. I mean, that's a very clear moral in the American tale.
Yeah, I always figure those movies exist to make us feel better that we're not wealthy.
That is one of the reasons that they exist, sure. I mean, it's comforting to know that there goes X or Y, you know, bathed in jewels or sitting at the back of a yacht and the poor man or woman is not happy.
Well, you talk about a friend who's making $250,000 a year, but is constantly feeling in desperate straits because it's just not nearly enough to keep the family in the lifestyle they're accustomed to.
Right. Well, that's a fairly characteristic American tale. I mean, if you go, the personal debt today is, that's to say, the kind of credit card debt, and consumer debt, I'm not even talking about mortgages, is larger than the national deficit. It's enormous. I mean, there are a number of people in this country who are living beyond their means is a very large number. And they're doing so for reasons much like the friend that I cite in the book, because they're trying to maintain a level of appearance or a level of, it's a variation on keeping up with the Joneses. And we're doing it both at the private level and at the public level. We are bankrupting the country, in my view, to maintain a military establishment, which is a form of opulent display.
You discuss some of the differences between old money and new money, and you say that new money is more fun to be around. Would you explain?
Well, if you're with the whole story of America, of course, is the story of old money giving of new money becoming old money, and so forth and so on. It's a great comedy. It's a great joke, of course, because the new money arrivists today, somebody like say Donald Trump in New York, is regarded by the old money, that is to say, the money that's had its, the people that have had their money for one or two generations, look down their patrician noses at Mr. Trump and say that he is an arrivist and so forth, but is precisely the sort of thing that was being said about the Rockefeller family in the early years of the 20th century. So that is a constant theme. Now, the difference is that the people who have, the reason that the new money is fun to be around is because they are likely to be people who have made it themselves as opposed to have inherited it, and therefore they are not as afraid of it. They having made a fortune, they know they can make another fortune, so that money becomes a kind of, they spend it far more freely than do the people who have inherited it. And therefore, they are fun to be around because they don't mind sending limousines across town at the middle of the night for a ham sandwich or a copy of Proust. They can enjoy it because it's real to them, and it's something they know they can replenish.
Louis Lapham is my guest. You also say that the old rich recognize each other by subtler clues than the nouveau rich.
Right. The nouveau riche tend to buy their forms of recognition and self-esteem. They buy the yacht, they buy the house in Palm Springs, they buy the $5,000 dress or the $20,000 watch or the $50,000 coat or whatever it is, and they recognize each other by the toys that they collect. You know, the old rich tend to recognize each other by the places that they've been brought up. I mean, they say, do you remember such and such a golf course, or do you remember what the light was like in Southampton or Greenwich, Connecticut or Burlingame, California when we were all 3 years old and so forth. I mean, and by the schools that they've been to or the clubs to which they belong. I mean, they're like tokens and emblems of their achieved status in the society.
This is one I find especially interesting. You say that new money thinks that its money is as good as anyone else's money, but what? But the old rich know better?
Yeah, sure the old rich know better. The old rich think that because they've had their money for two, three, four generations, their money has somehow cleansed them of the original sin of either greed or crime on which the fortune has been based. And therefore, they think they've been sitting in this club for 30 years, and that they are somehow more exalted than the newest arrival.
Louis Lapham is my guest. He's the editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of a new book titled Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. Now, you're from a wealthy family yourself. Do you feel like something of a traitor writing about the wealthy and writing about the foibles of the wealthy?
No, not at all. It's an old American... a writer writes about what one knows, so you write about the world in which with which you're familiar. I would not know how to write about the world of the urban slum, and I therefore write out of my own experience. This has been done many times before. Edith Wharton did the same thing, so did Henry Adams, to name but two. I mean, there are many others.
Your great-grandfather co-founded Texaco. Now, does that make you new rich or old rich? Does that make your family new or old rich?
Well, it would make my... Had my grandfather the wit to retain the fortune, which, of course, he did not. He lost. He lost it all. Therefore, I had to start over again. I mean, neither my father nor myself started out life with any real money at all. We had the pretensions and the illusions of a fortune, but we didn't have the wherewithal to maintain the illusion. Had my grandfather retained the fortune, I certainly would be old rich. I mean, to have made a fortune to be the heir of a fortune earned in the late 19th century would qualify me as definitely an old rich sort of person.
So you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up, but you had the...
You had the aura of it. The family used to sit around and tell these great stories about great-grandfather, right? And my grandfather, of course, was still alive, and he did have a considerable amount of money, which he spent as fast as he could.
But your family still had power. Your grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco.
Yeah. No, there was a shipping company, and my grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco, and after that went to... China with the Marshall Plan and then to Greece. So, yes, no, the family was walking around on the upper floors of San Francisco society. That's true.
You wrote that when you were a child, you frequently rode in limousines in public ceremonies, and you thought that you were born to ride in triumph and others were born to stand on the street and wave and smile. Was that kind of feeling encouraged?
No, it was very... I mean, you remember at the time I was 10 years old. My grandfather was the mayor of San Francisco during World War II, and therefore there were during the war there was a great deal of ceremony attached to being the mayor and presiding over the departure of troops and aircraft carriers into the Pacific. And it was a time when people did stand in the streets, and it was a time when people didn't carry a great many flags and so forth and so on. So you can imagine it from the point of view of a little boy, 10 years old, riding with his grandfather to the Kezar Stadium to review a battalion of troops or something. The kid could get quite confused.
You went to Hotchkiss and to Yale, to very prestigious, very expensive schools, and they're schools where it's assumed if you're there, you come from money. Now, you were telling us that your family had the aura of money at this point, but they didn't have that much actual money. Is this something that your friends knew about you? Was this something of a dirty secret for you?
No. You mean at Hotchkiss and Yale?
Yeah.
No, because everybody was in the same, more or less... I'm sorry, maybe I missed the question, but the point is that everybody at those schools was in more or less the same boat.
No, but you were saying that you didn't have as much money as it seemed.
Oh, no, I don't mean to say I was impoverished. I mean, the family was not what you would call big rich. It would be what you would call in, comfortable circumstances. Well, the family had enough to send me to educate me. It didn't have enough to buy lots of houses and boats and all of those sorts of things. But, I mean, it had enough to get me through school.
Did you try on a lot of different personalities while you were in college and away from your family?
Try on a lot of different personalities?
Yeah.
Including
being poor or bohemian.
Oh, yeah, I tried on bohemian. And because bohemian in those days, we're now talking about the 50s, and that was supposed to be the... if one wanted to be a writer... in those days. One was, you know, it was assumed that one would be a bohemian of some sort. It was an earlier variation of what the later became the counterculture style of the 60s. It's a matter of most people in college try on different parts.
Did your family ever give you guidelines on dealing with inherited money, how to spend it?
There wasn't any, so there...
Oh, I see. Okay.
there was no need for a handbook.
I'd like to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the subject of your new book, which is titled Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. My guest is Lewis Lapham, and he's the editor of Harper's Magazine. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Lewis Lapham is my guest, the editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of the new book, Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. Can I ask you why you wanted to go into newspaper reporting, which was how you started your profession, through your professional career?
Well, I started out thinking I wanted to be an historian, and then didn't quite have the fortitude to make it through an American graduate school. This is kind of terrible place to be, and I like to write, and I had a romantic notion of the newspaper business. In the 50s, that was the way one, it was a kind of an apprenticeship, it was the way one learned how to write. I mean, all of the important American writers of the 20s and 30s, people like O'Hara and Steinbeck and James M. Cain and so forth, Hemingway, had all started as newspaper reporters, and that was the way one learned the trade.
But you got out of that and switched to magazine writing.
Yeah, I switched to magazine writing because that was, again, I have a very much of an apprentice, long-term notion of learning how to write. So once you learn how to write the newspaper article, then you graduate up and learn to write the magazine piece, which is a longer form and a different sets of conventions.
Well, you're editing a magazine now, have been for years. Do you think that magazines have been changed by television?
Sure. I mean, when I first started writing in 1962 for the Saturday Evening Post, the Saturday Evening Post was like the television networks now. There's a direct analog. The large general interest magazine, Saturday Evening Post, Life, fulfill the function that the television networks now fill, so that magazine writing has changed a great deal. I mean, it's had to become much more specific and much more narrowly defined than it used to be. I mean, the large general interest magazine, it really no longer exists.
A lot of magazines, and I think including your magazine, Harper's, have gone to shorter stories than they once carried. Do you think that shorter stories are a function of shorter attention spans of readers, or do you think it's just that readers are busier and have less time to spend reading long stories?
I think that it's more the latter. I mean, it's not that they have shorter attention spans. Actually, they're more sophisticated, so that they will look most long. They haven't got a lot of time to waste on writing that is padded, or writing that or ideas with which they're already familiar. I mean, so what we do is it's the form is more concentrated for people who do read a lot of other things. There are some long things that are worth reading, not many, but some. Most nonfiction books are really an article inflated to the size that it can be sold at $18.95. I mean, most magazine articles, most long ones, can be reduced easily by more than half. And the intelligent reader doesn't have the patience to work his or her way through the dross.
You know, an interesting issue pertaining to magazines that I think also pertains to money and class in America is demographics. The way I understand it, magazines are much more demographically oriented than they used to be. And I've actually heard of magazines who limit their subscribers. They actually cut some subscribers out because their subscribers' demographics aren't that good. They don't make enough money. And the magazine wants to be able to tell its advertisers that, you know, 90% of its readers make in the $50,000 and above category or whatever.
Yeah, that's done all the time. And you begin to see it being done on television, too, pretty soon. They'll finally figure it out. But a magazine is sold not... The magazine is a bit of a contradiction because it's the business of a magazine is the same as the business of a billboard. It has nothing to do with the content. I mean, the way the magazine makes money is by delivering to an advertiser a space and a certain kind of audience or reader. And so that they increasingly, as the magazine business multiplies and proliferates, it tries to deliver to its advertiser only the most expensive readers. I mean, there are some companies, I think there's an insurance company called Chubb, that will only advertise in magazines that can prove that their average reader has a net worth of $500,000. So that because that's the kind of person to whom Chubb can sell its fancier financial services.
The ironic thing is, though, like say you have like 10,000 readers who have $1 million. What's the harm if like 10,000 other people read the magazine too and are subscribers, but they make a lot less? I mean, but the magazine wouldn't necessarily want them on the subscription rolls because it brings down the demographics.
Certainly. That's right. They cut them off. I mean, they're like people. It's the same attitude as you try to get, you know, you try to keep impoverished people out of your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them cluttering up the sidewalks and going to the schools.
Do you do that at your magazine?
No, we do not, because our magazine is sold on the basis of its, not on its demographics, but on its ideas. And that's why we have such a wonderful audience, because it's got a mixture of rich people, poor people, and so forth. The thing that holds them together is their curiosity of mind and their level of education.
You know, you are in...
But it's a small magazine, you understand. I mean, you couldn't do that if you had an enormous magazine, probably.
You are in a position of editorial power, and I'm sure many, many writers have passed through your office, new emerging writers trying to make an impression on you. Have people tried to impress you by dressing certain ways and by indicating that they are a part of a class that they're really not, whether it's an artistic class or a financial class? It seems to me you are very astute. You're very aware of the signals that people use to try to communicate class and bearing, and you'd be able to see through a lot of this.
It doesn't happen that much. I mean, it's a kind of a small... magazine, and there's not a lot of money to be made in these days in magazine writing. And so maybe if I were a person that was hiring scriptwriters for television series, that might happen to me. But almost all my decisions always are all made from what's on the paper. Somebody calls me up and says, I want to come and see you. And I said, well, look, just send me the manuscript and I'll read it.
Mm-hmm.
So... But again, the stakes in my end of the magazine business are really quite low.
You were explaining to us before that by the time you came of age, there really wasn't any money left to inherit in the family, although the family used to have a lot of money. And I wonder why you have remained so obsessed with issues pertaining to class and money.
Well, I've become obsessed with it because the society is obsessed with it, I think. The shaping of an attitude towards it is, after all, what American politics is all about. It is what the city of New York is about. It's increasingly what Washington is all about. It is the subject of the national conversation. And people don't, you know, if you get people in a room and somebody over in one corner starts talking about Marx or Flaubert and somebody in another corner is talking about an existential idea, these two conversations cease the moment somebody else comes in the room and starts talking about a magnificent real estate deal. You see, I mean, it is the subject of it is what the country talks about and thinks about. And if you look at the newspapers in any one day, the front page of the Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer or the, you know, Miami Herald, that's the subject. It's not my obsession. It's not my obsession alone. I mean, it is as if I'm some sort of recluse in a garret thinking about this subject. It's, you know, look at the proliferation of the business magazines. You know, people, or the constant conversation about the drug deals. Look at the stuff that's on television. Dynasty, Dallas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you like to watch those shows?
No.
Just to keep up with what's happening?
Well, occasionally, sure. But I mean, so I know what people are talking about, but it's not something that I would otherwise look at.
Tell me, we're speaking long distance. You're in a New York studio. I'm in a Philadelphia studio. If I were to see you now and see how you're dressed, how you're seated in your chair, would I know that you came from a wealthy family? I mean, do you still feel like that you have that kind of aura about you, that kind of presence?
I don't think you could tell that I was from a wealthy family. I think you could tell that I'd been to an Ivy League school.
How would I know that?
Well, I'm wearing a gray suit.
Oh, okay.
A rather conservative tie.
Now, do you want people to know that? Is that just, I mean, is that a signal you still want to give, or is that just what you're used to shopping for?
Well, I'm not Tom Wolfe, if that's what
right.
you mean. I mean, I'm not trying to create the image of a dandy or a person of a certain net worth. No, I don't dress that way. I've never thought it's that important.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right.
My guest has been Louis Lapham. He's the editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of the new book, Money and Class in America, Notes and Observations on Our Civil Religion. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.